in the Old Testament and the book of Genesis, beginning to read after the account of the flood in the 9th chapter of the book of Genesis and at the 18th verse. Genesis 9 and 18. The former verse says, "So God said to Noah, 'This is the sign of the covenant I have established between me and all life on the earth, the covenant of the rainbow with its promise.' The sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, of whom the Semites and the Hebrews, Abraham, Israel, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The order of their birth is not found here. Japheth is eldest, then Shem, and then Ham. And this order is undoubtedly because of the importance of Shem. Ham was the father of Canaan. These were the three sons of Noah, and from them came the people who were scattered over the earth. Noah, a man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard after the flood. When he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent, although there's a better reading than that that we'll look at later on. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders. Then they walked in backward and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned the other way so that they would not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done to him, he said, 'Cursed be Canaan,' not Ham, but his son. 'Cursed be Canaan. The lowest of slaves will he be to his brother.' He also said, 'Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend the territory of Japheth. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his slave.' After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. Altogether, Noah lived 950 years. And then he died. This is the account of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's sons, who themselves had sons after the flood. The sons of Japheth: Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. The sons of Gomer: Ashkenaz, Riphath, and Togarma. The sons of Javan: Elisha, Tarshish, the Kittim, and the Rodanim races. From these, the maritime people spread out into their territories by their clans within their nations, each with his own language. The sons of Ham: Cush, that is Ethiopia, Mizraim, which is the Hebrew for Egypt, Put, and Canaan, the sons of Cush. Seba, not Sheba, Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Raama, and Sabtika, the sons of Raama, Sheba, and Dedan. Cush was the father of Nimrod, who grew to be a mighty warrior on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. That is why it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The first centers of his kingdom were Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh, and Shinar. From that land, that's south Babylon toward the Persian Gulf, Shinar. From that land, he went to Assyria further north, Nineveh, the Tigris, where he built Nineveh. Rehoboth, Kala, and Rezin, which is between Nineveh and Kala, that is the great city. Mizraim, that is Egypt, was the father of the Luddites, Anamites, Lehabites, Naphtuhites, Pathrusites, Kazluhites, from whom the Philistines came, and Kaphtorites, Cyprus. Canaan was the father of Sidon. Now we're up the coast of what is called the Levant, the eastern coast of the Mediterranean. Sidon, his firstborn, and of the Hittites, the Jebusites, Jerusalem, remember? Amorites, which is sometimes a general name for the Canaanites, Girgashites, Hivites, Arkites, Sinites, Arvadites, Semarites, and Hamathites. Later, the Canaanite clans scattered, and the borders of Canaan reached from Sidon towards Gera, as far as Gaza, right down the coast there, towards Egypt. And then eastwards, towards the Dead Sea, and Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, and Zeboim. These four are mentioned, remember, in a judgment against them, as far as Lasha. These are the descendants of Ham by their clans and languages in their territories and nations. Sons also were born to Shem, the important one last, you see, whose older brother was Japheth. Shem was the ancestor of all the sons of Eber, Hebrews. The sons of Shem, Elam, remember the Elamites, Asher, the Assyrians, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram, that's also Assyria. The sons of Aram, Uz, Hul, Gether, and Meshech. Arphaxad was the father of Shelah, and Shelah the father of Eber. Two sons were born to Eber. One was named Peleg, because in his time the earth was divided. His brother was named Joktan. Joktan was the father of Almodad, Sheleph, Hazarmaveth, Chera, Hadoram, Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Abimael, Sheba, Ophir, Havilah, and Jobab. All these were sons of Joktan. The region where they lived stretched from Mesha toward Sephar, Sepharvaim, sometimes it's called, in the eastern hill country. These are the sons of Shem by their clans and languages in their territories and nations. These are the clans of Noah's sons, according to their lines of descent within their nations. From these, the nations spread out over the earth after the flood. Now, the whole world had one language after the flood, of course, and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar, Babylonia, as the footnote in the NIV says, and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and tar instead of mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens." That was the area from which the wise men came. Persia is the land of the astrologers, the stargazers, that reach to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, Ziggurat it is called. More of that later. The tower that the men were building. The Lord said, "If as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this," notice the word begun to do this, "then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come," says the Lord, and notice the plural, the Trinity, "come, let us go down and confuse their language so that they will not understand each other." A judgment for sin and arrogance and defiance of God. So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it is called Babel. And of course, Babel in Babylon is a significant word that runs right through to practically the end of the book of the Revelation. Odiously. Why it was called Babel? Because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. Amen. May God bless to us his holy word. The book of Genesis, chapter 9, verse 18, to chapter 11, verse 9. Last Sunday evening, we dwelt on the reverence and gratitude of Noah for deliverance from the deluge. Reverence which he displayed by erecting an altar to the Lord as soon as he emerged from the ark. And then he received God's covenant along with all life on earth. And everything was propitious for a new godly race, such as had earlier arrived with Seth following the murder of Abel. But there remained this fatal flaw of sin. And again let me stress that these subsequent new starts, we've had one or two in Genesis following the fall, these subsequent new starts which God gave man were not to teach God anything, but to show to man, not to say to devils, what the real situation is and how God alone is able to cope with and deal with the situation following the fall of man. The new race consisted of the three sons of Noah, Shem, of whom come the Semites and the Hebrews, Ham, of whom we have something particular to say this evening in due course, and Japheth. Chapter 10 giving us lists of the descendants of each of them, and some of them with very peculiar names. But here we are concerned, first of all, with Noah himself. Noah was a man of the soil, and doubtless had been a man of the soil before the Lord singled him out for his favor. Genesis 6 and 8. Noah found favor with the Lord, and the Lord commanded Noah to build an ark. Now, as an old man following the flood, he returns to the cultivation of the soil, and whether the departure to viniculture, vine growing, was absolutely new to him or not, the scholars speculate about it. He planted a vineyard and discovered the lusciousness of the grape and the pleasures of its juice with its attendant dangers. Now, we know a lot about the pagan worship of the god Bacchus, the god of wine. But Skinner, the Old Testament scholar, suggests that Lamech's prophecy, Noah's father, Lamech's prophecy of the relief from arduous toil which would result from the birth of his son Noah, 5:29. Lamech's prophecy points to the cultivation of the vine as a refinement of tillage and as a partial relief from the curse. How far, says Skinner, the fruit of the vine is looked upon as a divinely approved mode of alleviating the monotony of toil is hard to decide. He goes on, the moderate use of wine is certainly not condemned in the Old Testament. On the other hand, he says, it is impossible to doubt that the light in which Noah is exhibited here and the subsequent behavior of his youngest son are meant to convey an emphatic warning against the moral dangers attending this new step in human development and the degeneration to which it may lead. Unquote. And most scholars I have consulted tend to suggest that Noah's first experience of excess of wine was more or less accidental, while Calvin deals guardedly with the situation when he says it is commonly believed that wine was not in use before that time. He's quoting this opinion. And this opinion has been the more willingly received, says Calvin, as affording an honorable pretext for the excuse of Noah's sin. But, says John, it does not appear to me probable that the fruit of the vine, which excels all others, should have remained neglected and unprofitable. Also, he says, Moses does not say that Noah was drunken on the first day in which he tasted it. Therefore, leaving this question undetermined, which is very unusual for him, I rather suppose that we are to learn from the drunkenness of Noah what a filthy and detestable crime drunkenness is. Unquote. Yet the vine with the olive tree and the fig tree is a symbol. These are all biblical symbols in the Old Testament of the nation of Israel, aren't they? However, that which is given by God as a blessing, even if symbolic, is bound to be fraught with danger. Not because God's gifts are evil in themselves, never. It is the love of money which is the root of all evil, not the thing itself. God's blessings are bound to be fraught with danger, because there is an enemy, there is a Satan. But because the heart of man has perverted God's good ways through the influence of the dastardly work of God's enemy. And it is always God himself, of course, that the devil is getting at when he gets at man in all his specious wiles. Never forget that. Man is the devil's tool, his pawn. Never forget that. Man misuses the best of God's bounty. That's his sin. So we are not so much to stand in condemnation of Noah over this, albeit in God's sight he is very culpable, as we are to see how vulnerable we are to temptation by the best of things much more than the worst. The worst which hold no such attraction. It's the best of things that are the greatest danger to our being led astray from God, his best gifts. And I'm sure instantly we all say, yes, of course that's true, far too true. But you see, where the vulnerability and the culpability, sorry for the long words, but where the vulnerability and the culpability of Noah burgeoned, expanded with dire results. Compare Lot and his daughters. It's when the results of his drunkenness led to irresponsible and even obscene behavior. We recall how often a judge will say, in the case of a drunken driver mowing down some innocent pedestrian or killing another driver, the judge will say, drunkenness is no excuse. None. And while we may wish to give Noah the benefit of our ignorance about the total situation and our doubt about the matter, about his drunkenness being inadvertent, his subsequent behavior simply shows how soon even the godliest man can revert to wanton profligacy when the human temper is disturbed by even a moderate degree of intoxication. The truth is that the original Hebrew here does not say merely that he was, that Noah was uncovered, authorized version. Or with the New International Version, which most of us use, which says he lay uncovered. The original Hebrew says he uncovered himself. Now, when I realized that, I began to wonder why the translators of these modern translations had shown here such insensitivity to a very important point of morality. Mind you, the Good News Bible seems to go a little too far over the score when it paraphrases the passage. Noah became drunk, took off his clothes, and lay naked in his tent. That's going further than the original language. Yet the form of the original language is so definite. He uncovered himself. It's so definite that the deliberateness of Noah's intent is clear enough. However far he was presumably from his usual seemly dignity and modesty. He wasn't himself, of course, as no one is who is drunk. And this is the curse of drunkenness. Not only that it deranges the sanest and most sensible of folk. We see how that is intensified, manifold in the case of what are called hard drugs, when men go mad. Not only that it deranges the sanest and most sensible, but it brings out all that latent wickedness, which is, whether we know it or not, deep down in our sinful hearts, and which is open, however regenerate we may think we are, is open to the wiles of the devil. We are, if we knew it, the devil in the shadows. A deep well of sin and perversity and filth. Our human hearts. The devil must love strong drink for what it does to even the best of men. And see what trains of sin and evil follow. There was the Father, in all the deliberate, even if debauched, wantonness of his lascivious exhibitionism, and the coarse vulgarity of the remnants of his innately sinful nature being flaunted at the instigation of that uproarious devil who engineered the whole train of evil to the maximum discomfiture of a race which had been spared to do good and to honor God. How the devil laughed immediately after the flood and the altar. The great and good and godly man who had preached righteousness for over 100 years and built the ark is now lying besotted in obscene nakedness, in a stupor of drink. How the devil laughed at that. And you see, the next eventuality which boded ill for this branch of Noah's family was that his youngest son saw his father in all the grossness of his drunken, uncovered state. And instead of being filled with dismay and shame and moral shock at such an unseemly sight, his carnal soul was filled with an unfilial irreverence that gripped him with a sense of mocking amusement. And he ran out exultantly to communicate the outrageous spectacle to his brothers. But they were obviously of a different temper to the infant of the family. Like another famous person of a later day, they were not amused, but deeply shocked. There was nothing in these two fellows which had the slightest inclination to share their brother's irreverent mockery and derision. No, they would not look on their father's nakedness. that belonged to the obscenity of intrusion into the privacy of parenthood, as indeed the Lord has made plain in the Old Testament in the book of Leviticus chapter 18. Unfortunately, the New International Version obscures the meaning of the oft-repeated word in that chapter, uncover, whose terms, repeated a number of times throughout chapter 18, whose terms forbid the exposure of the privacies of the human body to any but those to whom it belongs. Where the authorized version reading from the Hebrew says, none of you shall approach to any that is near of kin to uncover their nakedness. I am the Lord. The nakedness of thy father or mother thou shalt not uncover. There follows a whole list of relationships concerning which this is forbidden. Now, doubtless the translators of the New International Version thought they were making more explicit what the authorized version, indeed the Hebrew, was seeking to say. But the New International Version, in doing so, goes beyond the generality of the statement there. And I believe goes beyond the warrant of the Hebrew word. The New International Version says, no one is to approach any close relative to have sexual relations. But the Hebrew doesn't speak about sexual relations. So that it seems to me that the prohibition is far more general than the modern translations, and a number of them, I think most of the modern ones, use this language about sexual relations. Quite a few do. That's not the Hebrew. Because, you see, we are not to suppose that young Ham was intending any sexual relationship with his father, which would obviously have been of a homosexual nature. Nothing of the kind. But the mere fact of looking, and if we are not reading too much into the text and the situation, and I'm sure we're not, gloating over his father's gross folly was sin enough to incur not only the displeasure, but the wrath of God, as evidence of verse 25 proves. The act of the brothers, Shem and Japheth, on the other hand, was exceedingly noble and showed a proper reverence for their father Noah's paternity. And you see, the ingenuity of their ruse to effect a speedy covering of their father's nakedness without their looking upon it indicates how desperate they were to minimize the shame their father would feel, not to say what their mother would think, when he was sober and knew what he had done in his cups. Indeed, if the brothers had not regarded the matter of the utmost moral seriousness, doubtless anticipating these laws I have been quoting from Leviticus, the whole proceeding would have seemed ridiculous and laughable to the point of theatricality, thereby justifying Ham's ridicule of his father. I suggest, in all seriousness, that two of you should try this sometime, to see how difficult it would be to walk two abreast, with a cloak draped on your shoulders down your backs, and then walk backwards. Poor Lord Hailsham would give you a lesson on that, for he has done a deal of walking backwards in the house of the Lord, walking stick and all, lest he turn his back upon his sovereign. I suggest that you try it. Draping a cloak over your shoulders, down the back, then walking backwards, to arrive at the proper place to drop the cloak on the drunken man, without turning or looking round. It was an ingenious and a brave and a worthy deed, and earned the blessing of their father, which is so important. And the blessing, you see, to Japheth, involves a great expansion of his descendants, as you see in the first verses of chapter 10. Kidner says, the peoples of this paragraph range from as far west, the descendants of Japheth, range from as far west as the Aegean Sea, that's between Greece and Turkey, to the vicinity of the Caspian Sea, stretching in a wide sweep north of the Fertile Crescent, that's the Levant, as the eastern shore of the Mediterranean is called. But, says Kidner, these are classified not purely geographically, but also by varied criteria of language, race, nation, which take into account the shifting and the mingling to which human groups are subject, as we well know in our day. And Kidner goes on, Gomer, he's talking about the descendants of Japheth, Gomer is generally identified with the Cimmerians, a name still used by the Welsh, Cymru. Then Magog also, Tubal, and Meshech, come from the uttermost parts of the north. See Ezekiel 38, verses 2 and 6, and Ezekiel 39, verses 1 and 2. Madai are evidently the Medes, of whom we'll be reading in Daniel chapter 6 on Wednesday. West of the Caspian Sea, the Medes. Javan, the Ionians, a branch of the Greeks. Kidner says to see the Ugaritic texts, which I suppose you all have by your bedside. The sons of Gomer and Javan could be peoples either descended from or subordinate to these two. The firmest identification of Ashkenaz, we have a penis of practically that name, haven't we? Of Ashkenaz is with the Scythians, and Kittim with the inhabitants of Cyprus and its neighboring coasts. Rodanim, of course, with the people of Rhodes. And the Isles are for the far distant parts toward the west, maybe as far as ourselves. That's Japheth then. As to Ham, something of major importance falls to be said about him. And you may have heard the frequently stated view that what has been called the curse of Ham has resulted throughout subsequent history. The satisfactory explanation that I have ever heard of has been found for the fact that the curse was laid on the son and not on the actual perpetrator of the outrageously irreverent deed by Ham. Of course, the sons of Ham transmigrated to Mizraim, Egypt, and to Cush, which is Ethiopia. But Canaan, see chapter 10, verses 15 to 19. But Canaan peopled the land which Israel was commanded to take from the Canaanites. What was it the Lord later said to Abraham about the 400 years his descendants would be slaves in a country not their own? What was it? that long bondage would be because they would be in bondage for 400 years in Egypt because the iniquity of the Amorites, a general name for the Canaanites, the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet full. They hadn't committed all their wickedness, which would cause God to wipe them out of Canaan for their sins. Therefore, there is in fact no curse on Ham whatsoever. And so, whatever we may think of Africa and its peoples, we cannot pin that on them. Indeed, our hearts ought to go out in sympathy and understanding to the African peoples for all they have had to suffer, especially this last century at the hands of the Boers. Which word Boer? I would like to spell with a double O for the appalling boorishness of their treatment of the native Africans in their own land. Listen to what a Kenyan, who is professor and head of Department of Political Science in the University of Michigan, USA, says. The fact that African identity and history is so interwoven with suffering and humiliation does not preclude the reality that although perhaps not the most brutalized of peoples, and that's a question, I think, they are certainly the most humiliated of any people in modern history. This quotation is taken from a book, The African Condition, published in 1980. However, my dear friend Philip Mwindi, pastor of West Hills Christian Fellowship, Philip Mwindi, who is also a Kenyan, has written, set against these problems, however, is the fact which Philip says, dawned on him a few years ago in studying Genesis, that the curse was to fall on Canaan and not on Cush, Ham. And a promise, he says, which he discovered in Psalm 68, verse 31, speaks of Ethiopia stretching out her hands to God. And the Revised Standard Version translated, Ethiopia shall hasten to stretch out her hands to God. And Philip adds, in a note he sent me some years ago, this text suggests to me that however grim Africa's lot may be in human history and calculations, we may yet live to see the day when Ethiopia and her God would do business at the center of the very stage come arena where she suffered humiliation for so long. And all this, he adds, to the glory of God, the terrible God, verse 35 of Psalm 68. All to the glory of God, the terrible God, who gives power and strength to his people. And indeed, to read the long list of descendants of Ham under Cush is to see many nations with familiar names on the great landmass which we may well call Arabia, first cousins of the Africans. There was the famous Nimrod, an individual, obviously, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And then there was Babylon and Assyria and Nineveh. And if we pass over the nations of Mizraim, Egypt, including the Philistines from Kaphtor, and look at the sons of Canaan, the cursed one, we see that they are the Canaanite nations which God commanded Israel to drive out of the promised land because of the fullness of their sins. The Sidonians, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, etc., etc. And look at Gaza and Sodom and Gomorrah and Admah and Zeboim. So much then for Ham. And now to the descendants of Shem. You see why the traditional order of the three brothers is not according to their age. Japheth being the eldest, Shem next, in the middle, and Ham the youngest. It is because the most significant name comes first, and that happens to be the middle son, Shem, the father of the Semites, of whom come Eber and the Hebrews, Genesis 14:13, Abraham the Hebrew, and of course, ultimately, Israel. Some of the Semites are difficult to pin down, although Joktan for the Arabs may be clear enough. The late D.J. Wiseman, who worked most of his scholarly life in the British Museum Antiquities Department, D.J. Wiseman suggests that Semites early penetrated Elam, even though they were later not dominant, whereas in Hamitic Assyria, they later inherited the Sumerian culture. And some of these territories, Kidner says, changed hands. So there's a limit to what we can inquire about them. These then, in chapter 10, conclude the account of these three sons. Are the clans of Noah's sons according to their lines of descent within their nations? Yes. From these the nations spread out over the earth after the flood. And you see, as the record moves on into chapter 11, we see the emphasis in the biblical record turning towards the Middle East and the great land mass that lies between Africa and India. Shinar is Babylonia, the area of such bitter conflict now with the concentration of warfare in the Persian Gulf area. Naturally following the flood and the new race of Noah's sons, the people of the earth would be of one language. And they also seem to have been of one determination, namely to make a name for themselves without any sign of acknowledging the God of heaven who had saved their fathers from utter destruction by the flood. They had early forgotten God. God doesn't come into this chapter, note, until we read that the Lord came down to see what they were doing. And when he saw that they were utterly godless in all but a superstitious heathen sense, so that they sought by building ziggurats, towers, to reach the heavens, whose gods to them were the sun, moon, and stars. Persia was the land of the astrologers. God came down to see what they were doing. I have pictures here of the remains of the ziggurat at Ur, Abraham's native place. And it was obviously somewhere in that location that God came down and created the Babel of confusion, which confounded their heathen intent to defy the living God. Do come and have a look at this picture, at this photograph of the remains of the Aryan ziggurat, and underneath it, in the same page, the reconstruction of what it would have looked like. You see it in the top, a ruin, and covered with men all round it. Whether they're excavating or whatever they're doing, you see underneath, you see a reconstruction of the ziggurat as it would have looked in its day. So, this is the prelude to the emergence on the scene, of course. This is the importance of the latter part of chapter 9 and 10 and 11. This is the prelude to the emergence on the scene of that mighty man Abraham. And we see, verses 10 to 26, the descent from Shem through Eber to Nahor, Terah, and Abraham. But what strikes you as you follow the trail right from the beginning of Genesis? What strikes you as you follow the trail from the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the garden through Cain's disastrous race with murder all mixed up with polygamy on the one hand and advance of knowledge and experience of the arts and the crafts on the other? Then on to the new race of Seth, and on through Enoch who walked with God to Methuselah and Noah, but alas also to the apparent intrusion of the specifically demonic into human life in chapter 6, leading to men of extraordinary power and size, but all very evil. What strikes you? What strikes me at any rate is that it is sufficient for God to say the whole record of evil, despite Seth and Enoch and Methuselah and Noah, it is sufficient for God to say that he regretted making man and determined to wipe him out. But Noah found grace shining out of the eyes of the Almighty. The Lord would try again. And you see why I made so much earlier of the divine plan, which seemed to be a course of trial and error. But the trial and error is not, as it may seem, a sequence of divine experiment. God is not trying in respect of himself to inform the Almighty and teach him lessons about the waywardness of fallen man. He knows all about that and knew all about it from the start, before the start, having seen one of his brightest angels fall away to become his implacable enemy, Satan. And then to see what Satan would do to God's prize creature, man. And this that we have seen in early Genesis, you see, whether we go on to pursue its subsequent course at this time or not, probably we will go on to Abraham, God willing, next Sunday evening. But whether we do or not, we have seen in early Genesis, we have seen sufficient to ponder long and deep the marvel of the Almighty's patience to put up with infinite experiment in order to show man the incorrigible nature of his sinfulness, and how, having initially defied his Maker at the fall, defied his Maker and his supreme benefactor, nothing that man may try to do on his own will come to any good, because he is, whether he knows it or not, under the malign influence of an alien master who prefers to stand in the shadows, so that man conceitedly attributes all his nefarious and willful experiments to his own initiative. Whereas, as I said earlier, man is really a tool of the devil. The devil, who is not above using the whole race of mankind in order to get at Almighty God, who made him, made the devil, and whom the devil hates and wants to unseat. To the devil, man is but a pawn on a chessboard, for him to gain the mastery over his detested Maker. Whereas to God, man is the crown of his creation, destined to rise to the dignity of being the bride and wife of Jehovah's only begotten Son, Jesus Christ. And it is the purpose of these early chapters of Genesis, beginning with the famous Protevangelium, chapter 3, verse 15. It is the purpose of these early chapters, bringing in from Genesis 3:15, to show to man, if he will allow God to open his eyes, what a confidence trick Satan has played on him to get him away from his Maker. And you know, it seems to me that if one reads the Old Testament without discerning plainly enough the monstrous and sinister shadow of the devil, this is the burden of my heart, and has been for many, many years. Say that again. If one reads the Old Testament without discerning plainly the monstrous and sinister shadow of the devil casting his evil spell over every effort of man to assert himself, then one has missed the point of the whole exercise of creation and redemption. Leave Satan out of account, which pious evangelicals love to do. That's one of the most shocking things about the evangelical world today. They love to soft pedal. Oh, they will say, we believe in him, of course. But they don't take him seriously. They don't reckon with him. Leave Satan out of account, my friends, and life will be a much greater mystery and puzzle and frustration to you than it need be. Oh yes, he is the key to all evil. But of course the great message of the Bible is that he has more than met his match, the silly fool that he is. He has more than met his match in his Maker, who is destined in the end to be his eternal destroyer, so that man may attain what God at the first intended him to attain, and will attain it, namely that royal seat by the side of his Redeemer Jesus Christ, on his throne by his Father. That's why I attach so much importance to the great 19th chapter of the book of the Revelation. I'm appalled that neither in the Psalms nor the paraphrases nor any hymns that we have in any of the 3 hymn books we use was there anything that deals in any way with the church as the bride of Christ. But I suggest to you, yes, this is why I attach so much importance to this chapter. Read it again, Revelation 19, before you sleep tonight, and marvel that you may be involved in anything so absolutely transcendent and glorious. The triumph over against the enemy of God and man. That you may be involved in anything so absolutely transcendent and glorious as being a part of the bride of Christ. That was God's purpose from the start. And man may fail, and God may seem to try again and again to teach man how vulnerable he is. But God in the end will have his way and will have his will. And we shall be cleansed from all sin and purified. We shall be his glorious bride, the bride of Christ. Oh, read of that in that chapter and exult at the knowledge of what is the believer's destiny. And rejoice your heart, and as Robin Day says, sleep soundly thereafter. Hymn number 205. The church's one foundation is Jesus Christ her Lord. She is his new creation by water and the word. For heaven he came and sought her to be his holy bride. With his own blood he bought her, and for her life he died. 205. Lord, may this great inheritance that thou hast given us be ours now in the greatest fullness that can inhabit our mortal bodies. The grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit. May these three in the wonderful triunity of their eternal being be our portion now and ever.